Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode number 23. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Scroobius Pip. Our guest this week is Mr. Dylan Moran, and I'll explain that stutter in the podcast and at the end. Before we get to that, sponsors, this week we are brought to you by Speech Development Records. That is my record label. Check us out. We're good. I recommend you coming and having a look. Go to speechdevelopmentrecords.com. You can buy CDs, DVDs, all sorts of other good stuff. I'm excited about this podcast, so I'm going to skim straight on quickly to our other sponsor, squarespace.com. I'm delighted to have Squarespace as one of our sponsors. It's a newer one we've had. I mentioned speechdevelopmentrecords.com and also scroobiuspip.co.uk. I built that with Squarespace. Squarespace is a website for building our websites, essentially. And it's really easy. I don't know. I basically had an old website that was really inaccessible, and I wanted to build a new one, and I didn't know anything about our websites or anything like that, but I heard about Squarespace on another podcast. So I went on there and had a look, and it was real simple drag and drop. Again, if you go to scroobiuspip.co.uk, you can see how nice it looks and how simple it is. And yeah, it's simple, powerful, and beautiful, they say. It's got a 24-hour live chat support, which is really helpful. It's only $8 a month, and you get a free domain name if you buy Squarespace. It's got cool, responsive design, which is one of the things I liked a lot. So my previous website, if you looked at it on a mobile phone, it didn't really fit because it wasn't built for that. But I only built this website on my laptop, and then I looked at it on my phone, and it adjusts it all, so it all kind of fits and is awesome. Every website comes with free online a store, so you can build your own store and sell stuff. It's just basically really good. Whatever you do, I had a guy hit me up recently. He's just started one. Him and his wife have a small design business, and they started one and literally built their website in half an hour. But the beauty here is you can get 10% off for listening to the show if you go to Squarespace and decide to sign up, because you can go and do their free trial with no credit card or anything else. You go and build your website, essentially, and if you like it at the end, exactly what I did. I built it, I was skeptical, and then at the end I was like, yep, I'll pay for this. So if you do decide to pay for it, you go to squarespace.com, and then if you enter the code PIP, you'll get 10% off your first purchase. And you'll also show support for the Distraction Pieces podcast, which is pretty nice of you. So thank you to Squarespace for being our sponsor. Squarespace built it beautiful. That's what it says on their bit of paper. What I say is they're just awesome, so check them out. This week's podcast guest, we get straight into it at the start about the fact I've got a video online called Stutter, and it's about my stutter. And one of the words I've always struggled with is this comedian's name. So we discussed that straight away. I've already said it at the start. So I'm going to go straight into that. I'm going to come back at the end, because the way the podcast went, I want to kind of explain the stuff from that video a bit more as well. So if that's all right with you, I'll be back at the end to talk about my stutter a bit, which you may not want to tune into. But for now, enjoy the podcast.
This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction.
And we've begun.
All right.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. This is going to be one of the more unusual starts, because at the start I always introduce my guest, and probably unbeknownst to you, we've got a history that you're completely unaware of.
Okay.
Basically, I've got a stutter. I've grown up with a stutter. And there's certain words that trigger it. And I did an online video showing people how a stutter works and techniques for getting through it. And the one thing I've always stuttered on is your name.
Just my name.
Just your name, completely
bizarrely.
Not
any other words with my letters, but just my name.
No, I even, like, so your name is Dylan Moran.
Yeah.
And that happens every time.
Yeah.
My friend's got a son called Dylan, who I can say perfectly fine.
Yeah.
But I can't say your name.
What if you ignore the back half of it, then?
So what? I don't know why. It's sort of weird. Right. A psychological thing. But I learned a technique of tapping out.
Yeah.
So if I tap out syllables, I can comfortably say Dylan Moran all day long.
Right.
Yet on its own, it's a weird glitch. So
well, I don't. It's really interesting.
I'm not after an apology.
I'm just trying to figure out how those things work. I mean,
it's fascinating, isn't it? The brain is such
stammers and so on are really interesting. I think
they really are. I don't understand them at all. I just did an interview with a guy for the Times newspaper, and he had a heavy stammer, and it was about our stammers, so you can imagine how long that discussion took.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's fascinating how really understands it.
I know a couple of performers at least who have had issues.
Yeah.
Stuttering or stammering issues. And then when they go on stage, nothing.
It seems,
absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it seems constantly on stage. Yeah, I do.
And it just goes completely.
I think part of it is being too distracted by everything else, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So because you're thinking about, I've got a crowd in front of me, I've got everything to deal with, the stuttering is the last thing on your mind.
Yeah.
I often, I'll add a letter, so I'll kind of slur a little bit and go, Dylan, see, I'm struggling with Dylan still. But and
what
it's
happens
a weird
what, you mean put an S in front of it or something?
No, I'll kind of lead into it with a bit of a Dylan Moran kind of, because it's always the first bit
that works.
Yeah, in that, as in general, it's the first word or the first start of it that's the bit that's hard to.
And what is there
to get over?
Any psychological difference between the motivations or the origins in a stutter and a stammer compared to a stammer?
I don't know. I always thought I had a stutter and a stammer is kind of a worse version. In this interview, I didn't really.
Is stammer not a repetition of the repeating the first, or there's a glitch syllable that people keep.
It can be. Apparently, it can vary. I'm learning a lot of this from today. There's covert stammers and overt stammers, I assume. Yeah. And the covert ones are ones that are more, you can mask it and hide it in an easy way. Whereas the overt ones, it's almost like almost more of a tick. Like it's quite a physical thing and quite, you know, harder to. But it's a lot of performers tend to.
Is it bound up in any kind of apprehension about what you're saying is going to be received? Or?
It's a weird one. Apparently, it's generally normally down to a traumatic experience. So I had hypnosis at like 13 or 14 and found out that the reason I have a stutter is because I almost drowned as a child.
Okay.
So it's tied into that. But still, I think it's such a grey area and such a confusing and unknown thing.
Yeah,
But obviously, we don't want to just talk about stammers the whole time and stutters. So how are you? Are you enjoying a rare trip to London?
It's not rare. I don't know. It's not. I don't do it all the time, certainly. And I know I'm
pleasantly rare.
This in this line of work, performing and writing and so on, everybody assumes you live in London.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And when my new pet bugbear is This happened a couple of times. People say, we have this meeting or we're going to talk about this thing. But I understand you're. I live in Edinburgh. People say, I understand you're based in Edinburgh. And
absolute shock.
I'm not. Yeah, the idea that somebody could live outside London. But the thing is, I'm not based anywhere. I live there. I wake up there. I go to sleep there.
Yeah.
I eat cornflakes there. I live there.
Yeah.
So because the implication with based is that you're based there, but actually you come to London when you really want to live.
Yeah. Exactly. Which is a little treat to get to come in and experience the real world.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
It's fascinating. What made you move to Edinburgh? What attracted you to Edinburgh rather than the glowing cool of London?
My life is there. My wife is there. My family are there.
That's perfect. That's a great reason. How was it growing up in Ireland and to get into stand-up? And what made you, where was your kind of starting point of, was stand-up the goal, or was it a route to get into act and write, or was it all kind of comedy as one?
No, the goal was just to do something, at the age of 19 or 20, as opposed to nothing. There was a tremendous amount of nothing on offer.
Yeah.
And, if you'd had enough
so
of that...
So appealing, it's free.
Yeah, it's if you've had enough of nothing, you want to do something.
Yeah.
So, that was approachable. You didn't need to put on any special boots or get any qualifications. You could just walk up and do it.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about it. You live or die, as you know, performing up there,
Yeah.
People say come back or they say go away. So
and it's clear. It's all off your own back. If you succeed,
can't blame
you
anyone
get the
else.
Glory.
Yeah.
If you fail, you can't say, well, it was that guy's fault or the manager or whatever.
It's nice and clear,
Yeah.
Especially with comedy, because you do your stuff and the people who are there let you know if they're enjoying it or not.
Yeah.
So that was it.
And what did you do to... Did you feel, regrettably, you had to come to London to progress with stand-up, with comedy?
Yeah,
you had to
come and do the monkey bars of the London circuit.
Yeah.
When I was 21 or whatever age I was. You had to come. And back then, there were... I think there's still a lot of clubs, but there were certainly over 100 clubs then. You could work every night of the week once you'd got established.
Yeah.
It wasn't that hard to get established. You go out, you get yourself around, whiz around the town. Sorry, whiz, as in with a H, not the other whiz. You go around town at speed and go to all the clubs and do your stuff and get asked back. And then you do 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and you start getting paid and you can begin to make a living. I think it's a lot tougher now.
Yeah.
I think you've got to really fling yourself around and... work for free for longer.
It's hard to do, surely, with the rate of living in London being so expensive now. I think it's got to be harder to get on that initial run of the ladder.
I mean, I don't know about London, because, when I lived here, it's the capital, it's expensive, it's busy, all that. But, the way you hear about it now is, oh, you can't do anything in London, a donut is £18,000, don't go outside.
It's a good donut, though.
Yeah, it's a really good donut, they're very expensive, though.
It's
so
got big Ben on it, the Union Jack. It's beautiful donut.
I went for a walk and had lunch with a friend, and now we're in debt for the rest of our lives. All that stuff. It can't be that bad, is it?
No. Again, I've never lived in London. I've always had that same thing of or two reasons. One being, I spend a lot of my life on tour and on the road. Mm-hmm. So why would I pay crazy rates to live somewhere that I'm not going to live much?
Billion pounds for a.
Donut,
a flat share.
A flat.
Yeah.
A flat above a donut shop. But equally, the same as you were saying, I've always felt, for me, I live in Essex, and everyone's goal in Essex is to move into London. That's kind of the aim, and to be inspired and be creative. I've always felt there's nothing more inspiring than having fuck all to do, like than boredom itself. As you were saying, if you get bored of not doing anything, then that... in my mind, can be one of the greatest motivators.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, God, you don't have to go in search of inspiration, I don't think, I mean, you can sort of mess around trying to figure out what the best way to do something is, but if you're going looking for mainframes of inspiration, Jesus, you're in trouble already, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. So, obviously you live in Edinburgh. What were your first, or how long did it take you to learn or see Edinburgh other than the Edinburgh that is the Edinburgh Fringe? Because it's a different Edinburgh. It's such a different beast and animal,
isn't
it?
It's on the map for all the performers who come up and they see a town that's sort of mid hootenanny at all times of the day and night. And then, it's by contrast, it's an incredibly quiet, conservative-seeming place.
Yeah.
In the rest of the year. But then again, anywhere else, anywhere would, after such a massive scale jamboree. So, it's a great city. Lots of character and depth and surprises. It's a wonderful place.
I was always... It sounds weird, but I was always shocked to go there outside of the Fringe
so
and
quiet.
See how quiet it is, see the colours of the walls. Mm-hmm. I just thought there was posters and billboards and adverts everywhere all year. And to actually see it
naked as such was,
well, I think it's
was quite a treat.
As a performer, when you're young and you go up there, it's quite a sort of a mind melt because everybody's just trying to make themselves in there, you know?
Yeah.
So it is a dreamscape for a month.
How important and inspiring was at the Edinburgh Fringe for you as a performer, obviously, to go there early and have to do so many shows and really graft?
It was really important. And you get good because you have to do not just two or three or four, five, but dozens of shows in a row. You're on all the time. You're running around between your shows. You're on again. And you just get, inevitably, you get better or die.
Yeah. It's a wonderful a testing ground, I think, to do. Obviously, every comedian... A comedy tours are known for being often just huge, month after month after month. But the Fringe is unique in that you get to do that, but in such a controlled environment, in the same venue, with the same lighting, with the same space. And I think that can be a great way to really hone your performance of those particular pieces, of everything, to get it kind of tighter rather than where touring is developing it with different audiences and the back and forth. So do you feel that, that helps and that's...
Yeah.
It's different from touring, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's good because it just means you've got to... Like you say, you've got to know what you're about. You've got to know what you're doing, you know? And and at the end of it, you should be able to be dropped from a plane anywhere and be able to do it in any ice cap or jungle in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Did you... was it hard when... Or how many years were you a struggling comedian in Edinburgh? And then obviously, I mean, you won a couple of awards up there, so there's obviously a change. I'd imagine it's a lot easier when things are going well than when you're struggling.
Yeah, I didn't. I did okay early on. Yeah. I did okay. You know, I it takes a year or two to find your feet, figure out what the hell you're doing. I don't think it was much more than that. It took me a couple of years in Britain.
Yeah, that's great.
And then I was able to get people to come to a small room and listen to me.
Yeah.
For an hour.
It's always nice. And
it was great. I was very determined, though. I wasn't doing much else at the time. Yeah. I wasn't really sloping off to, you know, perfect my game of croquet or anything. I was pretty much living and breathing, performing and writing, and that was it for me. That was all I was doing.
Did you feel any change or kind of... I know... I did 1 year at Edinburgh, but it was a spoken word show I'd toured for a while, and it was a small room, and I felt a level of guilt when it was going well, because generally when you go out afterwards and all the other comedians are talking about how hard a graft Edinburgh is and how your life's on the line, it was kind of, it seems lovely. It's kind of, there's crowds.
I never really
every
got around to enjoying the guilt about things going well, I have to say.
Good.
I didn't really bother with that. I mean, I say I was living and breathing it all the time. Maybe me retrospectively trying to justify it as work. I was performing and I was writing jokes and then, you know, lying around.
Enjoying life.
Yes, enjoying life being 20, whatever, of course. Yeah.
It's a crazy a situation because on one hand, 25 shows in a row or however many you end up doing is crazy. That's a lot. But on the other hand, that's 25 hours of work in a week.
Yeah,
and
the other thing is a mailman wouldn't come in and say, it's crazy, I've just done 25 days of delivering letters. You know, you go, right.
When I was being booked for it, they were like, you should have more days off slotted in. And I was like, it's 19 shows.
Yeah.
That's only 19 hours of work. You realise when you're there that the days off, like if I went again, I'd want days off just because of the stuff you clash with and the stuff you'd like to see and enjoy and things like that. But actually on paper, I couldn't get my head around the idea of needing...
Yeah, no, look, it's as much work as you want it to be. You know, you can write more stuff, you can try more things, you can worry about the show. But if you're going to complain about, you know, the 20 days or 25 days of work in a row, I think we're all probably better off if we do it quietly within ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. So how was it... How's it been to have tours kind of... growing and growing and growing and getting that that comfort in knowing that when you go to most towns, there will be a decent crowd there and they know who you are and they're there
it's funny,
your body of work.
If I think about it too much, it makes me want to dig a hole and get in.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what I'm doing. I don't. I mean, I do a lot of it, but I don't know what it is that I'm doing. And I write loads of stuff and I think about loads of different bits and pieces and how to join them up. and I kick it around and I go out and I try it out and I worry about it and then I think, oh, fuck it, I can't think about this anymore, this shit, I'm just going to go and talk. And that's sometimes what works.
Yeah.
And then I get into a funk about it every single time before it comes up and I think I have to stop thinking about it. And then something happens and I just do stop thinking about
it. Yeah.
I just do. And once I try and I can't believe I'm 20 years doing this stuff, but what happens is I stop thinking about it and then I start doing it.
Yeah.
And it's the same every time, and every single time, it's like I get fooled every single tour. I think, oh, at this time, I'm going to be super clear about everything. I'm going to lay everything out. It's going to be diagrammatic. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to be like the early part of some spy film where they lay out all the plans of the underground vaults and the bank. And then I always end up throwing all that shit away and just going, I don't know. I'll just do it like this. And that's what works. I've done it the same way forever, since I was about six, I think.
That's perfect.
And that's what happens. I just end up going, anyway.
Has that built a natural confidence in the ability to produce?
No, I've just sort of told you, no
hour.
Confidence. No every confidence single time I have the same crisis and the same answer, and I never learn anything. I'm like somebody who keeps on discovering that, you know, after thunder it will rain and you will get wet. Yeah. That's what happens.
Yeah, it's always that feeling of the. However many hours you've done successfully in the past have been a bit of luck, and
yes,
now it's all going to be exposed. That's happened now.
That's right.
I've got to come up with a new bit.
Everybody was napping. I just caught them unawares. That was fine. It was never happened again. Yeah, it'll go wrong.
I've always loved the Stuart Lee kind of anger at the love that Bill Hicks has and gets, because all he had to write was a couple of hours and then he got the pleasure of dying and that being secured in history, whereas you hard-working comedians have to come up with a new hour every year and sharp and still be funny.
I can easily imagine Stuart saying that, yeah.
So how was the balancing, or what is the difference for you on the writing stand-up for writing TV and stuff like that? Obviously Black Books was huge for you, and you know, coincided perfectly with the stand-up climbing as well.
Mm-hmm.
How is there a different process, or is it the same kind of nerves of, I don't know how to do this, we'll figure
no,
it out
not
on the day?
Really, you kind of get more time with writing telly or other kinds of writing, you know, you can kind of, there it is, it's looking back at you on the page, or you can you get more time to tug it around and bash it into different shapes. Whereas with stand-up, it has to kind of, you have to hear back there and then. The timing is there, you know, you make your sound, the audience has to make their sound.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's all gone wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas with the other stuff, you can mould it and mess around with it a bit longer. But at the same time, you have to get the response.
I was going to say, how do you kind of test it out or build the confidence in it? Because obviously with stand-up, you go out there and you try it, and if it doesn't work, you tweak it. If it doesn't work, you tweak it.
Well, for some things, like, do you have an audience? You've got there's a television audience,
sure.
You can tell, you get the noise back. But other stuff, you just have to trust that people will hear it in their heads the way you did when you wrote it.
Completely. But still, even with a television audience, it feels like it's already at that point now, if you know what I mean. It's already it's already completed, so it lives or dies as such, whereas it feels with stand-up, there's a lot of development along the way to that final piece.
It's completely collaborative, you know. I mean, the audience has a massive impact, and that's why the shows are different everywhere you go. Or it's one of the reasons why the shows are different everywhere
you go.
You know, I don't want to know everything that's going to happen before I walk on stage, wherever I am. There has to be a gulp element to it.
Yeah.
There has to be a feeling like, you know, you're on a tightrope. Otherwise, there's nothing to play for.
Yeah.
You know, so and there, everybody there is in that with you.
Yeah, of
course. They're sort of going, you know, they should be, a little bit of them should be thinking, fuck, I hope this works out, you know?
Yeah.
I hope this isn't a total waste of money and we have a terrible time. That should be going through people's minds, because it's kind of part of the chips you're bringing to the table, you know? You're all throwing in together. Let's make this thing work. Here we go.
It's got to be, in many ways, then, all the more nerve-wracking when putting all that time and effort into TV or into film or into anything like that, because there's so much, and so many other people have contributed and got involved before you know if it sinks or swims, essentially. How, you know, is that enjoyable, or is that the scary part of it? The wondering if it, you know, if it works, if it's.
I think it is. I think
the stakes feel that bit higher. If you know what I mean.
Would you mean for what, collaborative work or for solo work?
For solo work.
For solo, yeah, no, it is. It is part of the joy, the juice, the fun of it, the madness, because it is mad. It's probably in some ways an unhealthy thing to do. You're flooding yourself with adrenaline, you know, and scaring the shit out of yourself.
Yeah.
And then the flip side of that is that sometimes it's just brilliant. It's just completely liberating. It's just like falling backwards and expecting to land safely, and you do.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you find on the flip side all the collaborative work? How is that from generally originally writing stand up for your own voice, knowing where you want to go with it?
Well, I wouldn't. I mean, you know, I haven't written with anybody else in years, and I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah.
Very talented as some of those people were, but it's not that. It's just that I wouldn't enjoy that anymore. Acting is fine, because then that's quite good fun. You get to play somebody else's music, which is, you know, interesting to see if you can do it, if you can get it the way they want it. I quite enjoyed that. To join in an ensemble,
yeah,
you know,
part.
It's a nice relief not to have to feel like you've got to sort everything out, you know?
Yeah, yeah, completely.
The whole thing, I mean. And then I've toyed with the idea of something like, I love Mike Nichols and Elaine May, what they did, you know, I thought that was great, the dialogues they did. I'd love that idea. I keep tinkering with that sort of notion in my head of a man and a woman just kind of pulling at each other, stretching each other, kind of mess with each other a bit, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
mentally.
Definitely.
I think that's very funny.
Yeah.
To me, it's very funny.
Yeah, no, completely.
I quite like to do that. I wouldn't mind co-writing that with somebody.
Yeah. But then again, a lot of the beauty of a setup and thing like that is so much of it feels would be sitting down and having those conversations. And then obviously just structuring it, you know, building it and discussing it, but you know,
they improvised a lot.
Essentially, yeah,
they improvised a lot of those things. You know, they're really worthwhile if you haven't heard them. By the way, some of these sketches, they're very funny.
I definitely have to have a look. You probably saw from the slightly blank expression on my face as you were.
Well, you know, Mike Nichols was the film director who died, and Elaine May was the screenwriter.
Yeah,
they're really, really funny. Actually, they're kind of their time, some of their 60s and so on. But yeah, anyway, so something like that. I kind of like that Talking Heads idea, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm working on. I wrote these small books. I can show you one. I think that's just a prototype. It's not
excellent.
I wrote and illustrated these small books that I'm going to sell on tour. So there's about half a dozen of those, and they're about, you know, they're anthropomorphic. They're animals, but they're not. I'm talking to a couple of friends about possibly animating them. So we shall see.
That sounds good. What was the motivation there? I mean, purely as a title, Pig Gets a Quadruple Bypass. What, you know, what was the appeal? What was the draw there?
Well, people often use animals when they're exaggerating characteristics of people, and that's all I was doing, really.
Yeah.
So there's a pig and an owl, and there's a badger who's a poet, and there's a... bunch of emigres who have lunch and so on, and I don't know, that's what came, you know, that's what I had that day. There's no motivation. I wouldn't dress it up.
What a wonderful life it is, right, to be able to have this of things that I'd imagine with how many different areas you work in and have now, that a lot of stuff that comes to mind, you can either a work at this idea, or you know, decide, does this idea sit in my stand-up, or in a book, in a TV show, or
it's all stuff, you know? It's all stuff. It's all stuff you're making, and you just say, "Can I put this on the road? Can I put it?"
I definitely think that's got to be the best goal. I'm a big believer in, rather than thinking I'm a stand-up, I have to do this. Thinking I want to do good stuff. Just good stuff.
All you can say is, I've got this. It's hot. Who wants some?
Let's do it.
Perfect. Do you want it in a cup or a cone?
So I had both as Simon Pegg and Nick Frost on previously, and we spoke a lot about Shaun of the Dead from their perspective. How was it from yours? Was it, as you said, a kind of a pleasure to not... to get to enjoy it but not have the pressure of
being sure.
in control of everything
and taking your role. You know, I'd quite happily do something like that again, you know, where you just step in and you play a part. Like I say, it's a relief not to be carrying the structure around.
Yeah.
Not that I would want to give that up, but it's nice to get away from it as well.
Yeah, yeah. The balance of the two, I'd imagine.
Yeah, it's great. You get to play opposite people who are talented or good at what they're doing. Yeah.
How was it stepping into... one of my films of last year was Calvary, which I thought was absolutely amazing. And your performance, Glendon, sorry. I thought everyone was just absolutely mind-blowing in it. How was that? Because obviously there were a lot of moments of lightness and humour, but it was also a very dark and moving
film. It was great fun to do opposite, you know, really talented players, Brendan Deeson and... the film was full of talented people. Dave McSavage and
it's a huge ensemble cast.
A big cast. Aidan Gillen and so on. Lots of really, really talented people. And John, the director, was and writer, was good fun to work with. Like I say, you know, you come in, you do your bit, you play your bit of the tune, and you're out. I was in and out for that in a week. So
amazing.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to do something like that. Yeah. I mean, it's a different thing if you're trying to make one of those things yourself.
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
a huge
of course.
Undertaking. I'm delighted I didn't do that.
Yeah.
You know.
How is it then on a thing like that where you're in and out quite quickly? How is it to then see the finished piece?
It's great.
Do you have a great understanding when you're doing your small part of the whole lot, or do you then get to see it and go, oh, wow, I didn't
realise this was... Yeah, you don't know what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
And you see this thing, and it's huge, and it's cinematic, and Ireland looks great. I was very, really glad that they managed to do that.
Yeah.
We don't see very many cinematic films coming out of Ireland, particularly. You get a lot of these kind of intimate, close-up things that can be very effective, but there's no big screen element to them.
Yeah.
So I thought it looked amazing. Yeah, it's a revelation. It's great, because then you get to see it like a punter. You know, you're watching it and, oh, look, wow.
That's, here I am.
It's a bigger story than I imagined. Or, you know, there it is. It's a big canvas, and it was nice to be in a, you know, one corner of it.
Yeah. Who, growing up in Ireland then, at what point did you come over to London and to Edinburgh?
I was born in London. We moved back when I was 2, and then I was here when I was 20, 21, 20, something like that. 20, I think I was.
So who were your influences and inspirations to get into comedy, to do funny stuff?
Unemployment and fear were two big, decisive influences.
Powerful influences.
The threat of starvation and penury were really inspiring.
That's always good.
Yeah. So those people looking for inspiration, they should ask. I direct them towards the existential dread and fear of poverty. They're terrifically inspiring. That was it. I mean, seriously, I had practical necessity. Yeah, I couldn't do jack shit. I didn't have any qualifications at all. I still don't.
That's great. That must have a freshness then when you're walking into something almost blind, just going, right, this is... I need to get up here and make
absolutely.
People laugh.
Cause, you're spoofing because your life depends upon it.
Yeah. Are there many comedians at the moment that you're a big fan of, or that since you've got into comedy have had influence on
you? I don't watch a huge amount of comedy. Yeah. I'm not that interested in it, to be honest, a lot of the time. I'm interested in what I'm doing because I have to do it.
Yeah, completely.
And because I want to do it. I do laugh when I watch other people, but I don't spend a lot of time looking for the stuff, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And the people who really made me laugh are the same people who made a lot of people laugh, like Richard Pryor or Eddie.
Yeah.
Or Stuart's very good right now. He's doing great stuff. I mean, kind of all the names you can think of. I don't like everybody, but, you know, all the people who are out there. I enjoy people who make interesting choices, who try and push it a bit, you know?
Of course.
There's a lot more funny women around that I've noticed, you know, in the last while. It's like women have moved on themselves in that they don't come on and talk about being a woman, which mm-hmm. is really interesting, I think.
Yeah.
It means you can look past all that.
Yeah, and, completely.
And you don't even think about that because they're not thinking about it. I think that's a real step forward.
Yeah.
So there's really funny people out there who are women. You know, Susan Calman's very funny. Sarah Kendall's very good. There's loads of people. Yeah. You know,
it's great. It's interesting. A lot of people don't realise that when something is your job and your everyday, there's not if you're doing comedy most of the year, there's not a great appeal on your time off to go and watch some comedy or to take in some comedy.
I like laughing as much as the next person, but my own family are probably going to make me laugh more than anybody, you know,
yeah,
because
completely.
I think that's what you laugh at. You laugh at your familiars.
Yeah.
You know?
So you've got a tour coming up.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find a tour in life? Is it a necessity? Do you enjoy it? Are you used to it? And has it changed a lot, obviously, since having, you know, a family
to miss? I do enjoy it. I enjoy getting around. I like being in places that I don't really know where I am, and I have to ask lots of stupid questions about what's going on here. I do get a big buzz out of performing. I definitely do, because I like the transaction. I'm fascinated completely, but quite naturally by the process of trying to figure out how minds work, people's brains work, full stop. That's just interests me almost at every level, you know, physically, spiritually, neurologically, whatever way you want to describe it. I'm interested in that and how people view the world, why they do it that way, what their concerns are, you know. And it occurs to me that a lot of the things you talk about as a comic are the same things people would go and ask a fortune teller.
Right.
You know, they're going to ask what's going to make them laugh, what's going to agitate them, what's going to disturb them, disrupt them, make them make that noise is what's close to them. You know, their concerns about their health and the future and their family and will they be loved and, you know, will everything be all right? These are the big human forces that are the weather cycles that are rolling around inside all of us, you know. So there's not a want of interesting things to talk about. You know,
these are the
big moving forces in our lives.
Yeah. Do you tend to consciously consider a lot of that when structuring your set, or do you kind of just, as I said, it's the kind of natural things that would be discussed or would be of interest or of humour to you?
I think that's where I tend to dwell, I circle all that sort of area. I think that's where we do. So, you know, like I say, you know, whatever my highfalutin plans might be about different diagrammatics or approaches or diagnostics of how I should get into this and how I should look at this and how to open up this and analyse that, it does seem to sort of instinctively come back to that sort of, that's the beat, you know?
Yeah.
That's what you tend to stomp around and that's the fire you're poking with a stick, looking at that again and again and again. Why, you know, we're all kind of obsessional, I think, in the way we live our lives and what concerns us, you know? If somebody's worried about being unloved or somebody's worried about being broke, you know, these are the things that are going to kind of dog them all their days, it seems to me, a lot of the time.
Yeah, of course.
And we all have streaks of this or that and sometimes at different strengths over the arc of your life.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, I almost feel like it sounds like I'm describing some sort of shaman or witch doctor kind of methodology here. It's not that. It's just that I just think that we tend to dress up our own behaviour. We rationalise it a lot of the time and we like to glide over the animal or instinctive aspects of ourselves.
Yeah. So how much... with all of that, how much does a set tend to develop over a tour with the reaction and interaction and the exchange with the audience and with the crowd and with the humans there, rather than the ideas in your head or that you've slugged out previously?
It's funny, you can go to places where you just have places that have a really strong character, have a very strong identity. I sometimes feel like you get more work done there quicker because the character of the place imposes itself upon you in the same way a strong personality does. Like, if you go to Glasgow, you get a definite feel of a... Oh, it's almost like a person, you know?
Yeah.
Or Leeds or Sheffield. I mean, these are places that... Or Manchester. These are places you know, they come to mind. They've got a very, very definite sense of Cornwall. You know, Devon. There's different... When I say these names of places, they're not just place names to me. They're like people in my head, you know?
A distinctive style of crowd definitely. And kind of person you're going to be performing to.
Yeah. I mean, because if, you know, you swap these name places with one another, somebody says New York and somebody else says, you know, Idaho, you see totally different landscapes and fields from movies because you're so familiar with them. And it's the same in Britain, you know, if you get to move around, which is a privilege.
Yeah.
You have these, you build up these pretty layered associations with different places.
Do you consciously adjust your set or performance or plans with a preconception of how a crowd in a certain area will be, or is it more the crowd adjust it themselves essentially in their reaction, in what they...
No, I feel like I do walk on with preconceptions of places, but like I say, it's,
from having been there,
it tends to be around those places that have a very developed character. Yeah, like I walk on with a certain feel for York or wherever it is that I am, you know?
Yeah, of course. Have you got a preference in... Because, as I said, a lot of them, other than Cornwall, you listed there as having strong, distinctive characters, were all north. And, again, it is kind of known that a lot of the rowdier and more engaging crowds tend to be up that way.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that, you know, I'm interested that you remark on that they're all up north. They're just ones that came to mind, you know? But maybe there's something in that. Maybe there is something in that. Maybe that, you know, people would say in the South, these people keep their cards closer to their chest, possibly. Yeah. I don't know.
Or not even a North. If we bring Cornwall in there as well, it's all just they're all far away from London. And maybe that is that is a genuine how the character and distinction is built.
A West End crowd on a wet Tuesday night in November, that can be a rough crowd.
I'll go that far. Yeah, I'd guess so. Is it odd? I mean, we're recording this in Leicester Square. It's always been weird to me that Leicester Square and this area has such a heritage
of comedy.
In comedy clubs. And the fact is, a lot of them aren't there because they closed down. So you'd guess that's because they weren't working. Why does this area remain such a
this particular
a home?
Part of London?
Yeah, it seems to be. There seems to be. It's always been.
It must be just West End tradition or theatre theatre land.
I guess so.
I mean, the great thing about London audiences as well is that, you know, they have seen everything. They can see anything. Yeah. So they were great, you know, it was great as a training ground as a comic to go and play all the different parts of London. And
they were a good test and barometer.
Yeah.
I always remember seeing, I can't remember who it was, I think it might have been someone like Anthony Jeselnik assuring a crowd beforehand that they probably haven't seen that much comedy. He sees a lot. He can confirm that these jokes are funny and that they work because I'm a professional. I know what I'm doing. So, you know, it's on you to, if you don't get it, then,
it's because we're out in the wilds of Shepherd's Bush or whatever.
Slightly, and maybe you need to up your game.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we touched upon it briefly. How has touring changed for you? The older you've got, the more you've become rooted and got a family and things like that. Has that... as the experience of it changed a lot more for you?
It just means you really want to get out the other side alive, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, that's about it, you know? I look forward to doing it and I look forward to going home. It doesn't feel like... it's not that it's... It used to feel like life and death, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah.
And it still does to a degree because... But it only in terms of, you know... Will this work live or die?
Yeah,
not me.
I'm not.
I feel like my head's quite on the block in the way that it used to be. Because there was a time you think, I don't know if I can do, can I do this? I had to find out. And then I found out that I could do it, you know?
Yeah.
So, but what happens is you can do it and then you want to push it. You know, you want to make it more interesting. You want to change it up. You want to go to areas that you avoided because you thought, I'm not sure I understand this or it's risky or I'm going to offend people or I don't feel like I have developed an angle on this or whatever it is. You want to do everything. You want to do everything possible and you want to use everything you've got.
Yeah.
That definitely kicks in because you really do find that your threshold, your boredom threshold gets really reduced. You just won't put up with yourself. You won't put up with, you don't want to coast because you just drift off and crash into a lake immediately because it bores the shit out of you.
Yeah,
so
completely.
You really do want to use the time you've got. And time really comes into its own as a something you value.
Yeah.
After 20 years, you really, time is, I can't really speak highly of it enough. Precious stuff.
That's great. So that kind of becomes the motivation. I was going to say it kind of feels, it's a tough one to say, what do you prefer, but what are the different motivations or benefits from playing smaller, more intimate rooms to playing, you know, as some of the bigger venues you've reached now in your career? It's easy to get to a certain level, as you said, and coast, but obviously that becomes the last thing you want to do.
Right.
But what's the difference in the kind of...
The difference,
how do you feel?
Is
there a preference?
It's like in a small room, it's like you're wrestling with somebody, right?
Yeah.
So it's intimate, it's close up, you can feel each other moment by moment.
Yeah.
With a high degree of accuracy.
Yeah.
In a big room, it's like somebody's tied to a wall and you're at the other end of the room and you run at them and you punch them or kick them. And you've got, they can see you coming for longer, and you can feel yourself going towards them for longer, and you know it's going to happen, but you've got to land it just right for them to go, ah!
Yeah.
That's the difference.
That's perfect. And how does it become as well? You said with a London crowds, they've seen everything, obviously meaning a wide variation of stuff, but how has it been for you as a stand-up since the kind of dawn of YouTube and the internet and everything, kind of jokes potentially being spoiled in advance?
Well, you could worry about that.
Yeah.
Or you could choose not to.
Yeah.
I choose not to.
It's as simple as that.
I don't really give a fuck because, you know, it's just another thing to worry about.
Yeah.
And my inbox is already very full, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit. The other thing I did think about the filming thing was I used to get annoyed and go, stop filming it, you know, be here, because it was generally one person, two people tops. What are you doing? Because it was new then, right?
Yeah.
This is a few years ago. It's not new now, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I'm still amazed that an adult human being a few feet from me will hold a phone in front of their own face, never mind mine, and point it at me so that they are not having the experience.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly not having the experience of talking to them because they're interposing this slab of technology to protect themselves.
It's bizarre.
It is bizarre. But then I did think, well, you know what? So what? What if lots of people do it? And I think more people will do it. Maybe I should just say, okay, do all of you film it. Send me the footage. We'll cut it. Yeah. We'll make it the DVD. And then we'll sell it back to you. How's that?
Yeah.
Because we'll make a proper job of it. You don't know what you're doing, you clowns.
That's perfect. You get a good audio recording and you're absolutely covered. It's a bizarre thing, that nature of, or the feeling of, I need to record this to remember this experience, when in essence, in doing so, you're never experiencing
that
experience.
But in a way, that makes sense. Because
you're taking away the actual...
That's precisely it. But that makes sense if you think about it, because a lot of things you see, a lot of things that are offered up to you are actually a contract to get you out of experiencing anything.
Yeah.
A lot of what offers itself as entertainment or whatever is something designed specifically for you not to feel anything. And a lot of people want that.
Yeah.
That's why there's such a thing as, you know, lots of television programmes on Sunday nights, for example.
Yeah.
Or a lot of plays in the West End. People, or films, or whatever, or music, music. People want art that's not art. People want entertainment that's not entertainment, and lots of people want to make it as well, so that everybody can join in the vast conspiracy of nobody feeling anything.
Yeah, I think there is. I think it's a crazy thing that it's become all the more evident now that as a race, we've become really uncomfortable with having a moment to think. If you get somewhere early, you're panickingly on your phone to look at anything to stop you actually having to stand and think.
Alone time
for a second
is scarier than
petrifying,
ever.
Petrifying, right?
Yeah, it is. And that's another thing I do want to do in the show, and I do talk about in the show, is how alone you are. No matter how many phones, Christmas trees, computers, parties, trumpets, whatever it is you surround yourself with, you are a hot flea in the dark.
Yeah, perfect. That sounds wonderful. Well, we'll get on to where people can find out about the tour. Obviously, I'm going to have the dates again at the end. But what else is in the plan in the long run? Have you got more projects you're working on or writing? Or is it still the same?
I'm writing,
just going to do stuff.
I'm in the stuff mines with my stuff shoveled. Yeah, putting it into a stuff cart.
to get away from a lot of doing nothing, your solution was to do a lot of something.
Yeah, but equally,
but non-specific.
I will when there will come a time when I've had enough of that as well, and I plan to do lots of nothing.
Yeah, yeah, it's always good to have the balance between the two. Yeah. So is there more you're going to be doing with the books,
I'm going
or
to do
is
more
there
of these
more
books,
TV, film stuff?
Yeah, I'm going to do more of these books for sure. I'll probably do some of those, write some of those on the road when I'm out there as well, fixing the show, and then I'll take time off and I'll draw the pictures that'll go with them, because I find that if I try and do that, if I try and write and draw at the same time, I did notice that I want to kill myself.
Right, right.
So I'm not going to do that anymore, because it really did make me want to rip off my own head and post it somewhere far away.
Separate them.
Yeah, they need to be kept
surely.
Apart. Yeah.
Otherwise, they're going to compromise the. Otherwise, you'll draw one well and think that excuses a poorly written part, or vice versa.
Or I will just have banged my head off something heavy and sharp.
Either or aren't preferred. Yep. Okay, well, that's great. Well, where can people get keep up to date on everything?
I don't know.
No idea. Just,
I mean,
there's a wonderful thing called Google,
the internet,
which they can put
the
your name into.
The internet. I tell you what, it's going to be huge. The internet.
It seems accessible, to say the least, and it has a lot of information on there.
If you know somebody who has a computer, you're sorted.
Yeah, yeah, that's perfect. I'm always a fan of that thinking. I'm always uncomfortable when people have to reel off a list of Twitters, Facebooks and everything else, when in reality the quickest, if they want to know about the books, they just search your name and books, and when there's some news on it,
exactly,
it'll surface.
Yeah.
If they want to know about the tour, enter your name and tour. Magically, information will.
That's all you need to do.
It's all uploaded to Google regularly. You've got a team that upload all the important information regularly.
To
Google.
All there. That's it. And then you'll be sick of it and you won't want to hear about it anymore.
Exactly. Well, perfect. Thank you very much for coming along. It's been good to chat.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was the wonderful Dylan Moran. I tapped that out, as I said. Thank you for tuning in. As promised, I want to have a quick talk at the end here, because people ask me about my stutter a lot. And, you know, I'm doing a podcast and I've got a stutter, which is quite an unusual thing. I'm going to explain. I'll start at the beginning. I got my stutter. I had a traumatic experience as a child. At the age of 4 or 5, I was on holiday in France and almost drowned. They say for my kind of stutter, there tends to be a traumatic experience at the root of it. I got my stutter. I've kind of always had it growing up. A lot of people find it odd that I chose to go into something, you know, the podcast is speaking, obviously my music and rapping is, and spoken word is speaking. But I feel I genuinely feel that my stutter has benefited me and helped me in my career path, because it's really interesting. Again, I find it fascinating, as we just discussed it on the show at the start. I'm not shy about it. I find it intriguing because I don't understand it at all, and it's mine. I'd find myself a number one, I think it gave me a good ability to have two trains of thought at the same time. So in sound check, like Dan Lesak always, I used to laugh at this, because I'll be sound checking a song and doing my vocal, but at the same time I'll be writing a text and texting someone, say, oh, we need to go and sort this or do that. I genuinely think that and my half decent vocabulary came from the fact that as a kid, as a kind of survival tactic, if anything, I'd be thinking a word or two ahead in my sentence. I know I've said a lot of this, but I'd be thinking a good few words ahead and knowing that there's a word coming up that I'm going to stutter on. I'm stuttering there. And I'd be thinking of words I can replace that with. And I genuinely think that really widened my vocabulary. I guess also it could be why... just because I've... as a kid, I wasn't a big reader, and people hear my spoken word stuff and assume I'm a huge reader and had an amazing education. So much of it, I think, was that kind of
survival tactic. I needed to know more words and know more variations of words to use the ones I don't stutter on. Yeah, it's kind of weird. And also maybe, you know, I don't get that nervous on stage. I don't get nervous before I go out there. And part of that could be from having to overcome kind of always having to be nervous. Every conversation being essentially a performance of some sort because I'm aware I could fuck up. And it's a weird thing, man, because obviously there are far more serious things to have wrong, but people do dismiss things like stutters a little bit. But in reality, I've never known what it feels like to have complete freedom over what you say. And throughout history, people have died for freedom of speech, obviously. But that's something, in a literal term, I and others with a stutter have never had. You know, I literally, there's certain things I just can't say. And this new tactic, as I mentioned on the podcast, of tapping things out, which I learned from a guy who had a far worse stutter than me, is really good. And I think it's just a case of it's distracting you in some way and distracting your brain. Maybe that's why, like, when I rap and things like that, it's, you know, there's other things you're worrying about, so it's a distraction. But I don't know, I think it's kind of weird and kind of fascinating, so just wanted to talk a little bit about that with you. But I'll stop rambling now and go on to the next Distraction Pieces podcast. It's this week. Yeah, after last week's... So basically, last week we had Frank Turner and Billy Bragg, and it was hugely exciting, and we decided, right, let's try and go for a bit of March Madness, and we're going to attempt in March to have two podcasts a week for the whole of March, which is crazy. So coming up, we've got... so after this next one, we've got a Wes Borland and Rob the Bank, and hopefully Raoul Reynolds from Enter Shikari, maybe Jamal Edwards, Sarah Pascal. There's a load of people I'm trying to get lined up and talking to, and we're going to try and do two a week. But the second one this week is going to be one of just me, which doesn't sound very appealing. But basically, I had a lot of people asking if I would be interviewed on the podcast or get someone in to interview me. And I decided that's kind of shit, because if I'm getting someone in, I want to talk to them about them. So I instead did a Facebook post and got all you guys to ask me questions. And then for a podcast, I've sat down, I've recorded it just before I did this intro. I've sat down and answered a load of your questions. Turns out there was a lot more questions than I expected, and it took a lot longer. So I've split it into two. So this week, we've got part one of the Scroobius Pip on his own Ask Me Anything one. And at some point at another time, there will be part two. I've recorded them both, but we don't know when we're going to do it. What I would suggest is the best way to not miss it would be to subscribe and click automatic download. And then automatically, it will just come up on your phone and it will say, you got a new podcast to listen to, dude. So yeah, check that out. If you've enjoyed this one, I recommend going back and listening to maybe the Stuart Lee one, the Rufus Hound one, the Josie Long one. There's been some good comedians on, a Russell Brand, a Simon Pegg, Nick Frost. Yeah, there's some good people to go back and check out. So please do that. And until next week, when it'll just be me on... No, until later on this week, when it'll just be me on my own. This has been the Distraction Pieces podcast, and I thank you very much for tuning in. See you in a bit.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.